In front of you is this thing. So next, after that, we're going to do a deep dive into the SERP recommendations, and they're color-coded. So we're going to do a prioritization exercise with cards that you don't have yet, but will look like this. So we're going to have you sort of look at that list that's in color, the things that are already going, the things in red that we need to wait for CARB approval to do. But then with everything else that's black, we're going to be asking you to prioritize what you love, what you like, and if you don't like or love it, then you don't have to put it up. And then we will wrap up. But I hope everyone got to see the cool van out front. As always, there's food and restrooms out to the left. Help yourself at any time. And thanks for coming back. Welcome to the implementation phase.
All right. Good evening, everyone. Thanks again so much for being here. For those that don't know me, my name is Jessica Olson, and I am a program manager with the Science and Planning Department at the district. And I'm here today to give you what I think is a much anticipated update on the Community Air Monitoring Program. So moving forward, so we met in August, I believe it was August 26th, and for those of you that were here, you might recall, and for those of you that don't, a quick recap, we had a big mapping exercise where we went over all of the community air monitoring assets that we have available to us, and we went through an exercise where the community worked together to kind of determine where they thought the needs of the monitoring could be located, both within the city of Shafter limits, like the city limits, and the larger 7-mile radius that incorporates a lot of the communities that we're concerned about here. And so with that exercise, we sort of determined some priority areas and came up with a really nice map that I think really distributed a lot of our assets pretty nicely. Even before we had that exercise, we had already deployed two PM 2.5 monitors, and we'll go over where all of these are in a moment here. And then we're sort of in various stages ever since we did that mapping exercise almost 2 months ago. We're kind of in various stages of deploying those monitors, and I'll kind of give you an update on every single monitor and kind of where it's at in the various stages. We do need assistance with kind of some help determining one more site location, and I'll go over that as well. And hopefully, even with that assistance that we'll need from you from this one additional site, we expect to be underway with all of our community deployments, or at least our goal is to be expected by the end of this year. So in the next couple months, wrap up all of the site agreements, some of the logistics we're working on, and again, figuring out one more community monitoring location. So that's just kind of an overview of where we're at. Just kind of as a recap, this is all on your slides, and we've gone over it many times, so I didn't want to go through too much detail here, but just here in this upper left-hand corner, this is a picture of what you just saw outside. These are our mobile air monitoring vans. So that's one of the main resources that I think we're going to use for a lot of sort of the rural areas on the outside of Shafter, as well as the inner, you know, city limits of Shafter that are sort of in the unmonitored areas. It can measure a lot of pollutants that Brad just went over, including PM 2.5, ozone, NOx, black carbon, a lot of those things that are from the sources of concern we've talked about a lot over this past year. Up here on the upper right-hand corner, this is a compact monitoring trailer system. As we'll go over here in a moment, this is sort of planned right now, or at least where we're in sort of negotiations with Sequoia Elementary School to place that. Measuring kind of similar things to the van, so that's black carbon, PM 2.5, ozone, some other sort of precursors to a lot of those, as well as some toxics measurements. Down here, this is our fully loaded air monitoring trailer. Your committee, and again, we'll go over this in a moment, I think voted, if I'm not mistaken, for this to be kind of near the farm labor camp, and so we're kind of in talks with them as well, and this is more loaded than the van. So not only does it have all of those pollutants that I mentioned, but it also can measure a slew of toxic components. So this could be really, really useful for identifying a number of toxics that could be coming from a variety of sources within that area. And then finally, in this bottom right-hand corner, we're going to be talking about it a lot because it's the platform we kind of have the most of in the area, and that's the PM 2.5 monitor. And we have a variety of different places where that monitor is being deployed. This is a map, and if you want to kind of use this as a reference for the rest of the slides, we've numbered these here just to kind of go over where the community, again, voted with those little sticky dots we used to place the monitoring. So just briefly, and again, we'll go over this in a moment, number one, is actually Shafter DMV. Number two, and these are all labeled on your slides and every slide coming up, is Grimway Academy. Three is Sequoia Elementary School. Four is Golden Oak. Five is the Farm Labor Camp. And six is the Cherokee Strip Mexican Colony area. We also have this route. This was sort of the route based on a lot of the points of interest for the van. This doesn't mean it's the only place it's going to go. This is just sort of the focus route that we want to monitor. Again, kind of near the Cherokee Strip Mexican Colony area. There were some areas of concern out here to the southwest, some areas of concern up here near Wasco, and some areas of concern over by the airport that we've committed to monitoring a little more closely than we are doing with kind of the rest of the remaining areas in the Shafter boundary. So just briefly, site number one, I won't go into it too much because it's been running the longest. We deployed real-time PM 2.5 here back in February, and based on a lot of community input, we deployed a real-time PM 10 monitor in August. And so that's a temporary EBAM that we deployed thanks to the assistance of CARB, and those have both been running on the Shafter DMV site, and we've been updating that PM 2.5 measurements in real time on our district's community air monitoring site. And then as John will go over later, we've done a lot of good sort of trends analysis comparing these and actually the other monitor that we have deployed with our regulatory monitoring network that's kind of in the surrounding area. So we'll go over that in just a few moments here. Our second, like I mentioned, is Grimway Academy. That's what something we've also been running for a few months now, and that was began kind of at the end of June, and that is also that BAM unit, the real-time PM 2.5 monitor, that's on the roof of Grimway Academy, which is kind of in that southwest corner of the Shafter district, or Shafter area, rather. So site number three, now we're getting into things that have yet to be deployed, but are definitely very, very close. Site number three is Sequoia Elementary. As I mentioned, it's that compact air monitoring system that measures all of these different components up here. It can be trailer or platform mounted, and it requires security, power, and access. And the reason that I'm telling you this is sort of why it takes a little bit longer for us to deploy something like this. It's a little bit larger. We need to make sure it's in a secure location, that people can't come in and vandalize or try to otherwise mess with the monitor. We need power. It needs to be plugged in somewhere so it can operate, and it's a little bit more power than like our smaller monitoring systems. I mean, we need access. We need some of our air quality instrument specialists. Actually, we have a couple of them in the back right now over by the food. This is Brad, and that's Alonzo. Of course, right while I got them while they're eating. We need them to have access to it. They need to go and maintain the machine, take a look if there's something that goes down or there's regular maintenance that needs to be done. They need to be able to do that. And so with that, we need to kind of have site agreements with the various locations that we're placing these. And so in this case, we're working with Richland Elementary or Richland Unified School District. We have been in talks with them kind of for a number of reasons. One, this is kind of a lot to put there. It's kind of interesting. It's something different. And two, we have a couple of different locations within the Richland Unified District that we want to place this monitoring equipment. We will also continue, our DPR will also continue, as you heard the last couple of meetings, to have pesticide monitoring at this location as well. Number four, also in the Richland Unified District, and that's kind of why I mentioned that, is placing a real-time PM 2.5 monitor at Golden Oak Elementary. Again, this requires security, power, and access, and all of these things kind of get worked out in these site agreements. Different principals and different site operators like different things and kind of have slightly different requirements depending on the site. So it kind of takes a little bit of a different negotiation hand. And so we're definitely underway, and we do expect, kind of as I mentioned earlier, within the next couple of months to have that underway. This is going to be platform mounted, not on the roof, which actually might give us some good understanding of really that ground level PM 2.5. We've heard a lot about idling trucks and truck traffic that kind of goes by right there on Laredo Highway near the children, right near, next to the playground. So we really hope to capture that here. Right now it is, but we're actually still determining that for some logistics reasons. The Golden Oak principal wants it. There's a couple of specific locations that are already fenced out that they've been trying to work with us on. That way we don't have to build another fence and build out power all the way out there. So there's kind of, that's kind of near, there's some portables nearby that already have power. We might be working, there might be a light pole we can access. So that's kind of that region that we're looking at. And of course, kind of based on a lot of the feedback we've gotten, we do want as best as possible to get it as close as possible to that freeway. Great question. Number five, this one we're really excited about. We've been in discussions with the Housing Authority of Kern County. That main kind of upper left-hand corner or that northwestern corner of the Shafter boundary is where this farm labor camp is located. It was a main concern for a lot of you. And what I think is really interesting about this is depending on general wind direction, our usual prevailing wind direction, this is typically upwind of the rest of the community. So this should give us a really good idea of sort of what's coming into the community. And we already know, given some discussions we've had with the Housing Authority, that this has the power and some of the other site arrangements that we are really looking for. So we're going to, I think we might work with them on expanding some of the power requirements. It takes a little bit more of an upgraded power and upgraded access for this larger trailer. But we're really working well with the Housing Authority. And again, we hope to get this going kind of as soon as we can in the next couple months and get that trailer out there. Number five. So this one is where we need your help. We have looked at a couple of different locations in Mexican Colony. And one of them is called, and I'm looking at Brad, La Gardena? Is that a place? Yes. And it's a sort of this shop that's right on, right here on Manel Avenue. And we thought we might be able to place a PM2.5 monitor there. And kind of given some of the scouting that we've done, it doesn't look like it really has sort of the safety or power requirements that we require for in order to put something on the roof and have our technicians access it in sort of a safe manner. And so we've kind of looked around, and there aren't really a lot of publicly accessible, secure locations with power access directly in both of these places, or either of these places, I should say. So there's a couple of things I think we can ask from you, and this can be maybe given time. It could be at the end of this presentation, or it could really be after the meeting, come to us or email us or think about it for maybe until the next meeting. Where in this region or kind of around this region do you think we can place that? And to give you some examples, a lot of what you've seen we've done are on schools or on businesses that have really secure roofs that other people regularly access, like janitor staff or something of that nature. So if there's a place you can think of in that area that has something like that, let us know. We have found a few areas, and this is, again, where we'll want some of the feedback. And again, think about it, let us know. There are a couple of places about a mile north that we know we can place. It won't be directly in Mexican Colony and Cherokee Strip, but we wanted to hear from you first because, of course, we know that that's a really major concern for you, and we don't want to place something kind of without coming to the committee and letting you know kind of what our restrictions are and what these challenges are. So I'm just kind of letting you know. We're open to a lot of that feedback, and again, kind of given the rest of the time here, we can field that discussion, or we can just kind of get some feedback and maybe bring it up at the next meeting. Second to last, we have the air monitoring van. And as I mentioned, and I won't go too much into detail, all of these sort of points that we're pointing to really were just sites that you all voted on with your sort of sticky dots last time of sites of concern. And what I want to point out here is, especially right now, until we can figure out where we're placing a PM2.5 monitor, we do have that same PM2.5 monitor is in that van right now. We are going to focus as much as possible on Mexican Colony and Cherokee Strip regularly. So we want to make sure we still measure around there as much as we can. And so that's certainly going to be a focus, especially until we get some sort of PM2.5 monitoring, at least near that area, because we certainly understand that that's a priority. We also will be going really throughout the entire boundary, as mentioned, to some of these other areas of concern. Pretty regularly, and we hope to expect that pretty soon. As you saw, it's pretty up and running, and we're really excited to get that one going. And then finally, I didn't want you to think that this wasn't on the original map, but we just wanted to kind of show you this. These are the areas that the committee voted on last time that kind of ranked highest in areas that we would then pass on to DPR as recommended areas for additional monitoring. So we are going to have a DPR update. about a variety of things right after this presentation, but I just wanted to let you know that as we work with DPR and as that kind of continues to evolve, we have these committee recommendations already documented, and this will all go into the updated community air monitoring plan. And so with that, to go over some of that data I mentioned, is John Klassen, and he is the director of the Air Quality and Science and Planning Department.
Thank you, Jess, and great to be here tonight. Thank you. So it looks like Tom is the only one willing to sit in the front row here. So thank you, Tom. So I'm going to take a few minutes here just to go over some of the data that we've collected so far here in Shafter. For PM 2.5, we have a couple of sites that we've been measuring here for a number of months, and I'm also going to show PM 10 that we've been measuring over the past few months. So this first chart that we're showing here is for the month of March. As Jess mentioned, we started measuring PM 2.5 at the Shafter DMV site in February. We started getting things going by the end of the month, so March was the first full month that we had data available here in Shafter. And we're comparing this against Bakersfield, California, just south of here at that site that ARB operates. And then our Corcoran site just north of here. So we have PM 2.5 measured for all these sites. These are 24-hour averages shown for each day during the month of March. And you may not be able to see in your printout, that's in black and white, I just noticed, so you probably can't see the colors very well, but you can see on here that Shafter is the yellow color, Bakersfield is blue, and Corcoran is orange. So you can see they track pretty closely early in the month. As time goes on, you can see Bakersfield and Corcoran tends to be a little bit higher than Shafter, but then they kind of fluctuate throughout the month. So they tracked pretty closely for the month, but when we look at the average for the whole month, as we show in the table here, for the month of March, in the first quarter of 2019, Bakersfield, California was almost 7 micrograms as an average for the month. Corcoran was almost the same, but just a little bit less. And then Shafter at the DMV was a little bit less than that. So they all measured below 7 micrograms, but Shafter was just a little bit cleaner during this time frame. Looking at the second quarter now, so April through June of this year, again, we're showing the same three sites, Bakersfield, California, Corcoran, and the Shafter DMV site. There's a lot more variation here throughout the month, but you can, again, see that Shafter is the yellow line. For the most part, if you look closely, it tends to be a little bit lower than Bakersfield and Corcoran throughout most of this time period. And when we look at the average, again, for this period, for this quarter, Bakersfield was the highest at just over 8 micrograms, Corcoran a little bit less, between 7 and 8 micrograms, and Shafter was the best out of the three at about 6.5 micrograms for the second quarter of 2019. Okay, now for the most recent data. This is July 1st through just a few days ago in the first week of October. This is pretty much the third quarter of the year. Now we have a fourth site on the chart here, Shafter-Grimway. We started measuring here at the end of June, so now we have a number of months of data we're showing here for Shafter-Grimway. And you can see on the left-hand side that huge spike. That's the 4th of July. We often see very high PM 2.5 from fireworks. We saw that in Bakersfield. We saw that in Corcoran. Looks like Shafter. The same sort of thing happens here. Fireworks happen. PM 2.5 spikes up for the day, then it drops right back down the next day. So we saw that same kind of reaction here in Shafter. As you look forward to the right, look at the yellow and the green lines. That's Shafter DMV and Shafter Grimway. You can see for the most part they track a little bit lower than Bakersfield and Corcoran throughout most of that time period. We see a couple of spikes in the data right about here. This is an area of poor dispersion where the numbers kind of jumped up. All the sites did that. We had some wildfires here, some other periods of poor dispersion. So they all kind of track the same way, going up and going down. But for the most part, the PM 2.5 that we measured here in Shafter was a little bit better than what we saw in Bakersfield and in Corcoran. Also on the far right-hand side here, this is getting into October, so we're getting more into the peak part of the season for PM 2.5 as we get into November, December, January. We're really going to see the numbers probably jump up in Bakersfield. I'm guessing here in Shafter, too, we'll see the same sort of thing, but we'll get a better idea of what happens during the peak part of the season here in a few months as we keep taking measurements here in Shafter and comparing that against Bakersfield, Corcoran, and other sites. So the average for the third quarter, approximately, for these sites, again, Bakersfield, California was on the top at almost 10 micrograms for the average. Corcoran a little bit better at 9.8. Shafter DMV was, again, pretty clean, about 7 micrograms. And Shafter Grimway was a little bit more, a little bit higher at about 8.5 micrograms for the average for this time period. This next chart is just a particular day of interest that we looked at for PM 2.5. This is just one day, showing hour by hour the measurements throughout the day, just to see the variation between the two Shafter sites and then Bakersfield and Corcoran to see how they vary. This is a particularly stable day, stable atmosphere. You can see the concentrations were a little elevated, going from 15 up to 25, a little bit higher. So numbers a little bit higher on a day like this in early October. So you can kind of see the variation. The yellow line here is Shafter DMV. It starts a little bit lower. By early morning, it kind of spikes up. And Tom had seen this too, looking at the data, that oftentimes at Shafter DMV, there's like a morning spike that could be from increased traffic around the area as people are getting going, driving around. You can see the numbers maybe jump up just a little bit by that DMV site being right downtown there. And then as the daytime heating increases, it kind of expands the amount of atmosphere that the particulate matter is within. So you can kind of see a drop in particulate sometimes during the early afternoon. And you can see a lot more variation at other sites. Corcoran kind of went up and down a little bit more throughout this period. Shafter Groomway kind of had an up and down, similar to Shafter DMV, kind of spiked in the morning and kind of went down a little bit. So just to give you an idea of how things can vary here in Shafter versus other sites in the area. And now for PM10, just a couple of charts for PM10. So we started measuring PM10 at the Shafter DMV site at the end of August. So this is showing the daily 24-hour average throughout this time period from August 22nd through October 10th. And we have three sites that we're showing here. We're showing Shafter in yellow. This is the Shafter DMV site. We're also showing Oildale, which is just on the north side of Bakersfield. So that's essentially kind of the Bakersfield urban area on the north part. And then Corcoran, just north of here as well. So we can see the comparison throughout this time period that, for the most part, Shafter has been better for PM10. It's tracked pretty well with Corcoran and Oildale as different episodes come up. Poor dispersion, they kind of go up a little bit higher. We've had a couple of high wind events during this time period. You can see this big spike here on September 7th was a high wind event. We saw a big spike in data in Oildale. Concentrations went way up. Same in Corcoran, and Shafter went up as well. That's not quite as high as what we saw in Oildale and Corcoran. Similar for what just happened a week ago, we had another high wind event and some wildfires that were impacting the area, and all three sites spiked up at that time period, but Corcoran and Oildale both spiked up quite a bit more than what we saw in Shafter. So when we look at the averages for that time period, throughout all those days, Oildale and Corcoran were about the same. About 73 to 74 micrograms, and Shafter was quite a bit better so far at 46 micrograms. And this is just through that first week of October, so we're getting more. The harvest season is continuing. We'll see what happens with PM10 as we have another couple of months to look at. We'll see the variations and see how it looks through the end of this year to get a better idea of how things can compare as we get into November and December and so forth. And I think that's it. So that's the last slide on the data we have to show. So that's it for our update presentation. And
any questions so either to Jessica around the monitoring sites or John about the air quality data? I'm going to go Tom and then Maria.
So for John, how soon will we be able to go online and see this monitoring data in real time or within 24 hours or something like that?
Right. So the PM 2.5 data that is on our website, you can view that. That's updated every hour. But for PM10, it's not up there yet. So for PM10, we're working on the communications with the analyzer. So we're still trying to get that going and get that up on our site. I know CARB is also working on the statewide data portal where this data will also reside. So once that is available, historical data should be on there as well as real-time data so you can watch it throughout the day.
So it's up to CARB to finish before we have the historical data.
Yeah, and so I don't know if CARB has an update on the timing of it, but I believe
I'm going to go to Vernon.
Vernon has a quick update on that.
Yeah. Currently the can you hear me? Okay. Currently the system is up. It's distributing data in just files, so you can do file downloads, and so next steps will be making the system more user friendly. And I think our data team is working with the districts on how to transfer files, et cetera, and get them loaded. So that's in process.
Thanks, Brennan. John, I'll come to you after Maria.
For Jessica, Miré las estaciones donde van a poner los monitores, pero no veo el que haya un monitor destinado para donde está el 99. Ahí está una contaminación tremenda. Si pasan ustedes a las 10 de la noche hasta las 7 de la mañana. No sé si hay limpiador de aguas negras, de los drenajes, y el humo de la compañía del roof que está ahí. Ahí no puedes ni respirar cuando pasas a subir el 99. Y ese aroma se viene hasta Shafter, si dejas la ventana abierta. Si dejas la ventana abierta o alguna cosa abierta para dormir, se mete todo el olor para dentro de la casa.
Yeah, thank you. I think that was a main place where a lot of the folks voted, if you were recall during our August exercise, to have that van focus a lot of our time there. And so we certainly, that is a focus area, and we'll make sure that that's outlined really well in the CAMP, the Community Air Monitoring Plan, because I agree, that received a lot of votes, but I think it received a lot of votes for the van, and I think we wanted to be equitable and make sure that everyone on the steering committee had time to kind of consider where to place it, and a lot of the rest of the resources were sort of placed a little bit closer to where everyone lives. But we couldn't agree more that we want to capture things like that, that have sort of these other components, whether it's the mobile sources from 99 or the plant that you're talking about. So certainly taking that in right now, and this is kind of what all these update meetings are for. We want to hear places like that we can take our mobile monitoring van, deploy it as soon as possible, and make sure we measure around there. And then maybe, and this is kind of the point of having this sort of mobile modular air monitoring program, if we go and we deploy our van there and see that maybe it is truly an area of concern based on our measurements, we can consider, as we update the plan, deploying something kind of in the future there that's a little bit more stable.
Stable?
I don't think right now is the plan, just kind of given the exercise we've gone through, but I don't think that it's completely out of the question moving forward. I think the idea with some of the things that we've placed aren't going to be there the whole time. I think we want to kind of get some measurements maybe for a year or so and then move all of the monitors to different locations, and maybe that's kind of the next place. And so with the van, we can sort of get a good capture understanding now and say, you know what, the next place that deserves a monitor is this place right here, and then we can maybe place one there in the future.
Sí, porque creo que ahí no iba a haber impedimento de electricidad.
Gotcha. Great. Thank you.
I know I monitor the air stations in Lost Hills as well as here, but being able to monitor other stations and having, you know, access to that is a nice thing to have, and I'm not sure if I can look at the one in Corcoran or the ones in Oildale. Are they available?
So the PM 2.5 or the PM 10 in Oildale and the PM 10 in Corcoran, we post daily readings of that on the district's website. The PM 2.5 is available real time from the Bakersfield and the Corcoran monitor that we showed as well. Both on the district website. So maybe that's something we can add that to our community website, because right now it's sort of part of our regular regional network. And that could be a good suggestion for us to add those links directly if you want something.
Yeah, John, just to add to that too, on CARB's website too, we also push all of our data to them in real time hourly, and so does the rest of the state of California. So on CARB's website, you can view historical hourly data, historical 24-hour data for all these the regulatory sites. You can download data, take a look at it. So maybe, yeah, we can include a link on our site so the committee here can take a closer look at the data in the area.
And just so you, if you didn't notice, all of these comments and issues and concerns are being captured here on a flip chart. If anything is ever written that doesn't fully capture what you said, please just head up and we'll fix it. So we'll go to Gustavo, and then, sorry.
Yeah, this question is on for site number 6 for the Mexican colony. There's a like a community-based committee in the Mexican colony. I'm not sure if you guys have outreached. Dora, I'm not sure if she's here. I don't think she's here. But she, her, and Gary Rodriguez and other folks are a part of that. So I would love to connect you guys so you guys can start the conversation with them to see what other site locations are, like, available. And then for the kind of comparison of PM2.5, like, I see the concentrations and the averages. What is, just for, like, my sake, what's the, like, the standard, like, background for PM2.5 that's, like, you know, healthy or non-toxic?
So the annual standard is 12 micrograms right now. So on an annual basis, if you're below 12 micrograms, then according to EPA's health standards, that's okay. So seeing that, we're seeing measurements here in Shafter for many of the quarters, you know, below 10 micrograms. That's good to see that. We'll see during the winter season as we get, you know, into the peak season, we'll see how that compares to Bakersfield, Corcoran, Visalia, other areas. So that'll be the interesting test to see how that compares. Yeah.
Sí, por eso también habíamos pedido árboles en toda la Lerdo, hasta del 99 al 5, porque del 99 está la contaminación esa que dijo María, y para acá, para el lado del 5, están muchas huertas de almendra, que cuando fumigan, el químico se va a la tierra, a la orilla de la calle, y eso hace un microbio que da la fiebre del valle, y a mi familia ya le ha dado a mi nieta y a mi esposo. Por eso habíamos pedido esos árboles y también arreglo de yardas, que para que no se usara mucho los jardineros, porque eso es lo que contamina, ¿verdad? Así que si ponen los monitoreos y el aire está contaminado, no ganamos nada con eso. El chiste es arreglar lo que contamina.
And this, for the same question for the EPA criteria for annual concentrations on PM10, what is that?
So EPA has a standard right now for 24 hours. That's 150 micrograms for a 24-hour average. There is no EPA health standard for an annual average. It's 150 micrograms. So if you ever exceed 150 for your 24-hour average, you've exceeded the standard.
Okay, any other? Okay, I'm going to go John. Real quick.
I understand the valley fever concern, and that hasn't really been an issue for this committee. I'm just wondering, as this committee is going to go on, any links and how that may be aggravated as a result of any sort of air kinds of activities that we're looking at would be very helpful, especially for me to understand. You could put that on a list for future things to educate us about.
All right. Thank you, John. Yeah.
Thanks, John. Okay. Tom.
Okay. So in the winter season, people will start burning wood in their homes. Will a van be available to drive around at night to pick up smoke? Is that kind of thing possible?
Certainly possible. I mean, we'll have to look at our resources. That's a lot of time for our staff to do that. But I think we could probably find a time to do some measurements in neighborhoods. And yeah, I mean, the van, too, it has some capabilities of just trying to isolate particulate matter that can come from burning wood based on the color of the particulate matter. So you can try to isolate those sorts of things. So that could be a good test for using that equipment to try to understand what's happening in those neighborhoods in the evening.
Okay.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize what Annabelle was saying, that at night on Highway 99 in Laredo, that whole complex, industrial complex, it does get extremely foggy or hazy there at night with pollutants. But I don't know if you're just going to have a portable van out there. How often can it be out there at 10 o'clock at night when the air is actually the worst?
Yeah, I mean, there's a chance if we could find a secure spot somewhere in the area, we could place the van there for a number of days to measure, you know, what's happening there. So if we can find a secure spot with power that someone's willing to let us place something, then that's a potential that we could get a number of days of measurements.
Okay. All right. Any other final questions for John and Jessica? Is there one over here?
Crystal, I did want to mention, too, when we do our next update on air monitoring, we hope to have more than just particulate matter data, which is what we showed today. We hope to have a number of other pollutants to look at, different gaseous pollutants, maybe some toxics as we go forward. So the next time we give an update, we should have a lot more to look at in comparing what's happening in Shafter versus Bakersfield, Corcoran, Visalia, other areas. So we'll have a lot more to analyze and look at together over the coming months.
Great. Okay, so for the DPR presentation, we're going to start with Jesse Cuevas, who's the Chief Deputy Director, to do a quick intro, and then Edgar and Min are going to come up and do the wrap-up with more data.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jesse Cuevas. I am the Chief Deputy Director for the Department of Pesticide Regulation. I just wanted to thank everyone for allowing the department to come here once again and provide some information to the steering committee. The department really appreciates another opportunity to explain a little bit more about their programs, processes, and other ways that the department can collaborate with not only our own state agencies like the Air Resources Board, but also local partners like the air districts and a lot of the community residents and the community groups down here. I wanted to kind of just take a moment and recap. This is actually my first time here at the Shafter Steering Committee, but I've been at some other meetings here and there throughout the state, and so has Edgar and Min as well, and I think you've talked to them a couple times before. But really, a recap on the conversations here is that the department has been having conversations around air monitoring for pesticides in the community, and as you know, we've had an air monitor in Shafter for a couple years or so. And the department wants to continue having conversations about, you know, what more air monitors throughout the state or in this community could look like. Of course, you know, it's a lot of detail that have to go into it and a lot more discussions that have to go into exactly where monitors could go and the value of those monitors. And I did see here on the map earlier that there have been some potential locations looked at. So we look forward to those conversations. The other part is around pesticide notification systems. So given the, I guess, the potential complexities of a notification system around pesticides, the department is going to go ahead and start having more in-depth, thorough conversations with the community groups. And I wanted to welcome anyone in the steering committee or anyone of the community residents. If you want to be a part of any of those future conversations with the department on a potential notification system or what that could look like, we're really trying to better understand all the different options that are out there. So if you're interested in that, please come see me, you know, at a break or after the meeting, and I can get your information to include in future conversations. And then lastly, and the purpose why we're here today, is the department is looking at a statewide regulation for 1,3-dichloropropane for acute measures, short-term exposures to 1,3-D or T-lone. We've been working on this for quite a while now, and we just had a workshop last Thursday in Sacramento to go over this presentation that you'll see shortly, but to really solicit community feedback and feedback from the public on the different options that are out there to potentially mitigate 1,3-D and the potential effects of short-term exposure. This is really just, you know, the first of many conversations I think we'll have on this, and we will be looking to actually have more meetings or workshops throughout the state. In January, we'll go to various parts of the state. And so with that, I think if we have a lot of material to go through here, so I think we'll just kind of go quickly. But if you have questions, please let us know. Our purpose here is to really get through this information and make sure everyone understands what we're presenting, and also to get any feedback from the community residents as much as possible. And with that, Edgar Vidro.
Okay. Okay, so essentially, just to add a little bit to what Jesse mentioned, we had a workshop on Thursday in Sacramento where we went over some of the options that the department is considering to mitigate 1,3-D dichloropropane exposures. So what we're going to do for today, again, because of the short time frame that we have, and before I start, I just want to thank the Air District for allowing us to come here and actually go over this material with you. Like I said, we had it on Thursday, but we also thought it was appropriate to bring it over here and actually talk about these options with the steering committee, being that 1,3-D specifically has been brought up as a potential concern in this area. So with that said, what we're going to do here essentially is doing a very abbreviated version of the same workshop that we had last Thursday. Here what we're going to do is, again, the main rationale for this is to explore additional mitigation measures that the department is looking into to protect bystander and residents from short-term acute exposures to 1,3-dichloropropane. Again, these measures may include anything from buffer zone requirements, application rate limits, as well as possible tarping. So, and I know this is hard to read. Hopefully you have all the slides in front of you. But essentially what I want to go over here is some of these options that the department is considering. I do want to stress that this does not mean that only what's on the page is being considered. Or it also doesn't mean that everything that's on the page will make its way onto the final mitigation measures that the department put forth in regulation. Here, these are based on different mitigation strategies that the department has used in the past to address other fumigants and other pesticides. So the first one here is to continue to prohibit the 1,3-D applications during the month of December. The reason for this is that air monitoring has shown that during the month of December, the air concentrations for 1,3-D are usually higher than any other month compared to its use. So the air concentrations are not the highest compared to other months, but when you look at how much of 1,3-D has been used, it is quite a big jump in terms of concentration. So because we know that December usually has lower inversion layers and actually it has enough weather condition that leads to higher air concentrations, we have been prohibiting 1,3-D applications in December since 2017. So we are proposing to continue that prohibition. Another one that has been brought up in this committee, we are looking at possibly requiring the use of totally impermeable films or TIF tarps for either all applications or a portion of the applications. That's still yet to be decided. Three is require what we call the field management plan or FMP for every single 1,3-D application. A little background on this is that for every other fumigant application that happens in the state, they're required to supply a FMP for that application. The FMP has additional information about weather information, a specific information on how each application will actually take place, and some of the precautions that are in place or monitoring that the applicators will do. 1,3-D never received this update, so we're proposing to bring it up in par with the rest of the other fumigants. Similarly, we are proposing to every other fumigant went through US EPA's Phase 2 label update in 2012 that required the inclusion of emergency preparedness, response, and difficult to evacuate site information. Again, 1,3-D did not go through that update, so we're just hoping to bring it back in par with every other fumigant. The next one is to cap all application blocks at a certain acre limit. In this case, we're looking at 40 acres, and the reason for that, again, is because 40 acres has been used for other applications such as chlorpyrifos and some other regulations and mitigations that the department has put in place. This may not be what makes it onto the final, but again, this is just that we can cap a certain size limit because the smaller the size of the application, the lower the emissions. The next one is to require a certain minimum distance to what we call an occupied structure. Essentially, this will mean that if there's a house and somebody's inside the house, there's got to be a minimum distance between the edge of the field or where the treated field happened and that structure. In this case, we're saying 200 feet. It may be greater. It may be smaller. The next one is basically we do know that obviously 1,3-D is a widely used pesticide, so there can be multiple applications occurring within a certain space or a certain distance. In order to avoid or lower the possible emissions that can happen from these applications, we are proposing to distribute them within space and time. In other words, we're saying that if any two or more applications are going to take place within a 96-hour window, they should be at least 800 feet apart. And if they're not, then the combined size from all applications will equal the maximum that we're allowing for a single application within that time frame. This is with the idea that we will reduce the emissions that are taking place from either one application at a maximum amount or multiple applications at a lower size limit. Last one, or last few, is essentially we do know that not every single application behaves the same or releases the same amount of pesticides in the air. Different application methods have different emission profiles. For example, here we talked about method 1206, which is a untarp deep application method. That has a certain emission amount that occurs from every application compared to a method that uses TIF tarp, which in this case we have a number for that. It's method 1242. So because we know that we can't use a single option for every single method, we're proposing to either have a buffer zone distance and duration depending on the application method that's being used. The same thing with the application rates. Here what we're saying is that perhaps there can be a limit on how much of 1,3-D can be applied based on the application method that's being proposed to be used. Because again, some application methods have higher emissions, so we are gonna say that they can only apply a lower amount. What that amount is, we have yet to determine that. For methods that use tarpaulins or TIF tarps, we're proposing to extend the tarp cut time. The way it works right now, based on label requirements and permit conditions, when they have a tarp applied, they have to come back 9 days later to cut the tarp to begin the planting. We have noticed that there's an actual emission peak that occurs about a day after they cut. And even though the emissions are relatively lower compared to any other method, we're saying that in order to, for VOC purposes and for long-term air concentrations, we're proposing to extend that tarp cutting time there to lower the emissions that can happen during these applications. Another one is soil moisture requirements. Essentially here what we're saying is that data has shown that when the soil that is being fumigated has a higher soil moisture content, it's a little wetter, it tends to keep the fumigant on the ground a little bit better and the emissions are usually lower. So here we need to figure out what that level should be with the understanding that if the field is too wet, one, you can't really make the application, especially if you're using tractors and other equipment, and two, you might reduce how efficacious the pesticide may be. Again, the only reason why they're using the pesticide is to make sure that they're sterilizing the soil. If the pesticide cannot move, therefore it might not be efficacious and you won't actually get full control. Now, if it's too dry, the pesticide will leave the site and get into the air. So there has to be a balance, and we're trying to figure out what that balance is. Last one, we're actually looking into developing new application methods that will still allow the pesticide to be used at a lower rate or a different manner, but will still allow the emissions to be low enough to meet our health protected targets. This will be done through data, through studies, through modeling to figure out what those new methods may be. Now, what we're going to do for the next slides is we're going to have Min Pham, who is DPR's air program manager. His staff actually does everything from collecting air monitoring data to actually doing the air computer modeling as well as actually determining our mitigation measures for all fumigants. So he's going to talk about what some of these options actually look like in reality, and then we're going to come back and talk about what we need from the CERN committee.
Okay, thanks, Edgar. So my name is Min. You guys will probably see me in and around here. We monitor down at the Shafter Elementary School. So like Edgar said, we do both modeling and monitoring. So what I wanted to do is kind of give you a highlight of what my team has been doing. So what we did is compiling from all the research documents that we can get, monitoring data, weathering data, and everything in between. We try to get all that together to produce models for the 13 types of field fumigation methods currently available. We did that statewide, and we took a look at all the different scenarios. So right here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to highlight three pretty common field fumigation methods, FFMs. So 1201, 1206, and 1242. 1201 is produces the most emissions because it's a shallow injection. 1206 is the deeper injection. It's the most the most that you will see in the Central Valley. It's predominant around here. And 1242 is the TARP method. So as you can see, based on the two reference targets of 55 and 110, my team went in and modeled for all three of these FFMs. And I'll get into these numbers in the next couple of slides, but I wanted to show you that the buffer zones can be anywhere from 3,500 for 1201 to 1907 for the target of 110 versus the 55, I'm sorry. And then with the TIFF, the 1242 buffer zones are 62 feet for about a day and a half with the 55 ppb, or the buffer zones would be 23 at the 110 ppb at a little bit under one day. Okay, so visually, I put this together to kind of give you it more in a context. This is for 1206. This is the deep shank untarped. So what we have here, currently the inside square is the field. Right outside of that is our current mitigation measures, which is 100 feet distance at 7 days is the buffer duration. Assuming that you go at the full label rate of 332 pounds per acre, that's what you would get. Based on our modeling, when we did the two different reference targets, 110 ppb would give us about 1,000 feet at 4 days, 4.5 days. 55 ppb target reference would give us roughly 2,000 feet for buffer zones, 6.5 days for duration. So similarly, I did this to show context of the tarping. This is 1242 tarping. So as you can see, it's completely the reverse. The outside ring is what the current mitigation measures are. And as you move in, 23 feet for the 110 ppb and 62 feet for the 55 ppb. So as you can see with tarping, the buffer zones is actually a little bit more. It's less than the current mitigation measure requires. So we took a step back and tried to take a look at how this could be implemented. And an option that we looked at is, what if we just set a buffer zone of 200 feet or 500 feet for all applications? And what we did is, by working backwards, we were able to get the application rates for each of these few FFMs, field fumigation methods. So as you can see, I don't know if you have your handouts or not, but all the numbers are right up there, ranging from 41 pounds per acre at 200 feet, 62 pounds per acre at 500 feet for the 55 concentration, and a little bit double that as you move to the 110 ppb. The one thing I want to highlight here is for the 1242 TARP, because it allows, because of the tarping method, it will allow for the maximum application rate. So as you can see there, it stays at the 332. Pounds per acre. So similarly, I did a couple of these for context. As you can see, current mitigation measures around the field are the closest ring there at 332 pounds per acre, 100 feet buffer. As you move out to the 200 foot and the 500 foot, you have the corresponding application rates that are allowed for each of the concentration rates. Same thing here I did for the 1242. This is for the TARP. As you can see, it allows for the maximum application rate for no matter what target or what distance we have, which basically means that our mitigation measure as it is conservative enough to cover what we needed for buffer zone and buffer duration.
Okay. We only have about two slides more, and then again, that's we go into what we're asking from this committee today. Real quick, one slide on considerations. It's and I'm pretty sure you guys are all aware that 1-3-D is extensively used in California. There's an annual average of 12.6 million pounds, and that is between the first 5 years of the of this decade. Growers have been have transitioned from using methyl bromide previously, but it was phased out, so now they transition to 1-3-D. And I did want to kind of focus on this statement because on Thursday we showed the same slide, and there was some conversation that or comments made after about that the next bullet that we have, which it says there are currently no viable commercially scale alternatives to 1-3-D. And I want to just kind of emphasize one thing, that what we mean by this is not that there's no alternatives out there right now that can be used in any given area, whether state or county. What we mean here is that unlike the European Union and some other countries that have banned 1-3-D, the scale of the commercial, of the growing infrastructure that California has is very unique. Therefore, if we were to remove 1-3-D, phase that out as of today and then tomorrow, there's really nothing out there right now that will be a suitable alternative to keep the same kind of commercial scale that we currently have. That doesn't mean that that an alternative cannot be made available in a given time. That's basically what we're saying, is that currently there's no easy switch between 1-3-D and another product, or even requiring all TIV tarps. Currently, the manufacturer is not there. So that's what we mean by that there's a caveat there that currently we don't have anything viable to fully replace it overnight. Then, because it's widely used and we're looking into either reducing its use or making it safer to use, there's DPR is currently working with CDFA, or California Department of Food and Agriculture, to look at what is the cost analysis for this rulemaking. And this is not because of 1-3-D. Every California rulemaking package has to have incorporated a cost analysis that is done to assess what is the likelihood, or what costs are you likely imposing on California. So DPR usually works with CDFA for this. So right now they're currently doing a cost analysis for 1-3-D mitigation. Lastly, and this is the most important one, is, again, we understand that there's costs associated with this mitigation. We also understand that there's, again, some of the land may not be, let me rephrase that, current agricultural practices may not continue as they are once we put in new regulation. So we understand that there's some trade-offs that we are proposing. But again, the main goal of this is to mitigate unacceptable air concentrations that are due to 1-3-D. So that we always want to keep that in mind, and we want to make sure that whatever we propose, it applies and it works for all Californians. Timelines, what are we looking for? So we are proposing to notice a permanent rulemaking that addresses both acute, so short-term exposures, as well as cancer or lifetime exposures. And the reason for this is we already plan on doing a cancer rulemaking. Right now that we're doing an acute, we don't want to do two separate rulemakings. We want to put them into one, and that would be an easier process to go through. And we are proposing to do this next summer, at least begin the process. However, we are looking into doing a interim mitigation during that time frame between either January all the way to when we actually notice the rulemaking and when that rulemaking becomes effective. So during that time, we do plan on looking at alternatives of interim rulemaking or mitigation. And again, our plan is for the interim mitigations to actually mimic what we do for the permanent rulemaking, because we don't want to have something too stringent and then we relax once we have the permanent rulemaking, or the opposite way. And the interim mitigations may be in place as early as January. It all depends what, you know, what process the department takes and what those mitigations actually look like. So one thing we asked on Thursday was to actually allow for public comment on our options. Again, we haven't decided what the department will do. This is something that we are asking all stakeholders, from public all the way to industry and different groups, environmental justice groups, industry advocate groups. We're trying to figure out what, get everybody in the table essentially, and provide input on alternatives, on feasibility. So one thing we are asking everybody here is, we would like feedback, whether it's right now or in writing or later on when you think about what we propose. We would like to know about the feasibility and efficacy of the buffer zones, for example, that Min went through. At the end of this presentation, we actually have tables with all methods and all application, all buffer zone distances. So take a look at that and let us know what your thoughts. Also on the application rates, this is more on the efficacy part. So we have any growers, any applicators that are familiar with how much amount, have they ever used lower amount and gotten the same efficacy? We would like to know that. Then we are asking information on the feasibility and efficacy of any new methods. Again, we have several methods that we're proposing, and we're exploring way more, but we want to know your thoughts on that. Requiring tarpaulins or TIF tarps, how feasible would that be? If you have any information on that, do let us know. Also, have we ignored, have we not looked into other possible mitigation measures that you may have an input on? So if you have anything that you want to suggest for us to consider, do let us know. The timing and scope of implementation factors that we should consider, let us know if you think our timing is too long, it should be faster, it should be longer, we should be looking at alternatives during the lead-up time, what the implementation should look like. Lastly is, again, we understand that there's going to be an economic impact, so we want to know what is the trade-off in terms of economic impacts and environmental effects that may reduce from, for example, if we require TIF tarps, that increases the amount of plastic that's used in California. Again, it doesn't off-do or it doesn't overpower what the health effects will be, but it's one of those trade-offs that we have to be considerate of, and whether that actually has a weight or on a final decision or not, again, that's yet to be determined. And with any of this, and I know we're a little short on time, so I don't know if there's any time for questions or... we're going to be here after as well. If you have any comments or concerns, you can come talk to us.
Yeah, so, okay. Is this on? Okay, so we are 5 minutes over, but what I'd like to do is take 15 minutes away from our SERP exercise, if that's okay with you guys. Because I know this is an issue that's really important. We're just going to take questions of clarification or initial comments, but there's not enough time to go deep into this tonight. So what I ask is for a little bit of clarity about how folks here today can submit comments. Like, do they write and send Edgar a letter, or how do you guys want this?
So I know there's a email address, and I'll look for that right now. I don't have it with me, but I'll find that out. And before we leave, I'll give you what that email address will be.
Okay, so Edgar's going to put it up on a flip chart before we leave tonight. And if you have more additional comments or other thoughts and feedback, we'll get that. But we'll have about 10 minutes before we move on. I see Tom's hand. Who else initially? Bianca? Okay.
Okay. This is not very useful like this because I can't see what the current rules are. Can you email the committee a new paper that compares and contrasts what's currently in place to what's being proposed here? And second, is it your opinion that this would encourage more tarping if these things go in place?
I'm sorry, I didn't
quite. Is the intent of these things to encourage more tarping during application?
So that's one of the options that we're considering. Again, if we go by the emission amount, that we find that the tarping method has lower emissions compared to something else like untarped methods. Now, One thing that we're trying to, as we talk with more folks that are in the industry, and we find more information about each crop, we do see that for some crops, like lettuce, strawberries, and some other ones, it's easier to require tarps. For some other ones, like large trees, almonds, walnuts, it's a little more difficult, but we are exploring all options, including tarping, for a portion of the applications or all the applications.
Okay, but you're not thinking about encouraging simply by making it easier to apply 1,3-D if you tarp than if you don't.
What do you mean by making it easier?
Well, like you have a much smaller buffer zone requirement if you tarp.
Right, and that will be the case regardless because the buffer zones are determined based on emissions. Because that method has lower emissions, the buffer zones will be lower than any other method. That is then up to the applicator to see if they want to, if for some reason they're next to a sensitive site and they don't have any larger buffer zones, that might be an option that they will definitely look into to see if tarping is better for them. As a department, again, we want to explore all options, but we want to give every option that we put on the table should be produce emissions that are below the health protective levels that the department sets. So each, regardless of the option, it will meet those levels. Now, what option the growers or applicators take, that's going to be up to their specific situation.
Okay, and finally, you're not looking at the health standard itself for exposure, what is considered safe versus unsafe. Because there was controversy earlier in that OEHA recommended a more stringent, safer exposure, lower level considered safe.
Yeah,
are
so
you looking at that at all?
So one of the things that can be just because of the timing for this presentation, we do have the complete presentation that we gave on Thursday. It's on our website. That presentation that we gave on Thursday does have a slide or two about the target concentration that we're looking into. And right now, we are, and Min actually touched a little bit on it when he went over the different buffer zone distances. So we're looking at a target of 55 or 110. This is parts per billion. And we are working with our partners in OEHA, ARB, as part of our regular rulemaking process. And that is something that they have an input on. But so because we don't know where that will land in the future, we did wanted to show what it will look like if you go with either one.
Edgar, is there a way for folks in this room to get a copy of the full presentation that you used last Thursday?
Yes.
Do you want to email it out to the group?
Yes.
Okay.
I do have a question. You did mention the annual average is 12 million pounds, but we need to be as clear, as transparent as you can. In current, we're number one that uses a TILO 1,3-D. Is it right? Am I right or am I wrong?
I think, and I haven't looked at the numbers, but usually 1,3-D high use is, we have areas in the coast, Santa Maria, Santa Barbara area have a high use. There's some use in Imperial, some use in the Northern, but I don't know about, I haven't looked at the latest data, but yes, Kern County is usually one of the highest used counties, including Fresno, in the state.
Okay. Also, I want to piggyback on what Tom France was saying about OEHA having a higher standard for TILO than DPR. Why is that happening? Why do they have a higher standard for our health assessment than DPR that's supposed to do the litigation process for TILO?
Yeah, so one of the slides of the presentation that will be mailed to the committee and maybe their district can put it on their website. I'm not sure how, what they want to do with it. Essentially, one of those slides does talk about some of the toxicological background between the different targets that is being considered at this stage. OEHA is part of that work group that we have to go through as part of the rulemaking process for toxic air contaminants. So they are reviewing the work that we're doing, and they are we are in communication with on the final target that's chosen. I can't really speak to the intricacies of. I'm not a toxicologist, so if I say something, it's going to be based on my personal background in that. I don't want to confuse you or mislead you and say something that's not accurate. But that slide that I will send does have one or two slides that addresses the – and I think it has to do with the uncertainty factors that's used. But, again, I don't want to speak for the toxicologist. But we could also send you some links of some of the risk assessment document that's been produced, and that will hopefully address some of your questions.
Okay. I also wanted to mention on Thursday I was able to attend the DPR workshop you had, and somebody mentioned, I can't remember, it was a lady that was mentioning that as soon as they introduced T-Lone, something happened to the lab rats. Can you clarify what happened, or do you know, or do you not remember?
I don't want to speak for the toxicological aspect of this. I do know that most of our stuff is based on animal studies, and there's a certain protocol that they have to follow of how they introduce a fumigant and how they monitor them. But I can refer you to the studies or at least the review of the studies that either OEHA or DPR has done, but I'm not the right person to speak to that.
Okay. And lastly, sorry. You were mentioning it was going to be a recommendation on Thursday of having a tarp application. We know that in the coastal there's a lot of the strawberries. It's easier to tarp the application, but in Kern, there's more... We don't have that weather condition as strawberries or anything. We have hot for almonds and all those type of crops. And it's a variation that T-Lone is being used in. What ways, or what are you doing to consider the tarping here in Kern? That's because you said it depends on the grower. Yes, it does depend on the grower. But having that... an emphasis of having the tarp applications to not bring it into an air toxic contaminant and bring it into the air and contaminating the city. What are some of the thoughts there?
I'm going to start that, and then I'll let Min if he wants to add something, because his team is the one that's actually looking at multiple options of introducing tarp in untraditional applications. So as you are, obviously you guys are surrounded by orchards and you see how they're normally structured. You know that there's a row of trees, then there's an empty row where, you know, the tractor and all these other equipment go through, and then there's alternating rows. One of the options that we're looking into modeling, how it actually applies in the real world, it may not even work, but we're looking at perhaps requiring them to be able to tarp half the field, therefore reducing their emissions by half. Because the way that the emissions work is based on a square footage or an acre. So if you reduce the same thing with the application rate. If you reduce the application rate, you're removing the possible amount that can be applied later. So this method, what I'm talking about, it's called the TIF strip. So they're doing strips of TIF, and that may be something that could be explored further. I don't know if it worked in practice or if it even has enough emission reduction to even be considered. So that's something that we don't have any real world data on that. So this is more of a, you know, looking at the emission data and trying to model that. Another way of doing it is to possibly reduce a field size and have a portion of that field be tarp and a portion be untarp. And the third option will be to have the whole field tarp and then coming back later in planting the trees. And again, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
So yeah, my team has been going through a lot of different options, and a lot of the stuff we showed you there is we're getting to with the buffer zones that we showed, it's getting to a point where at that distance it's, you know, it's quote-unquote acceptable. So what we're doing is we're looking at different things rather than just tarping alone. We could take a look at soil moisture, different types of application technology. There's a lot of stuff out there that we're exploring, so we're trying not to just give one type of statewide kind of Band-Aid for the whole system. We're giving multiple options, and as long as each of those options hit the acceptable target range, that's what my team has been looking at as far as modeling and monitoring.
Great. Okay, thank you, Jesse, Edgar, and Min. Can you guys remind me real quick what the deadline to submit comments on this are?
End of the year.
End of the year. Yeah. So December 31st, 2019?
Real quick, one thing that I didn't mention, and it's important, and that's why at the end of the year, is that we're actually planning on having more detailed conversations with multiple stakeholders. So we do plan on having 3, 4, 5 multiple workshops coming up in the next year. So we do plan on taking them to the road, not just in Sacramento. So we do plan on going in the Central Valley and the coast and different regions where, you know, we want to hear from the people in those regions. So I do anticipate that we're probably going to have one in this area. And so for now, basically, we're taking comments on what we propose here, getting additional input. And then as we get closer to the summer, we'll have each time we'll narrow down the scope and have more real proposals and then still get people's and different stakeholders' input on that.
Great. Thank you. Okay. So just to recap, Edgar's going to provide an email that you can submit comments between now and the end of December. And there'll be a link, a series of links and information sent out after this, and that we will send out. The Air District is we, not I am, not we. The Air District will send out. We do need to move forward so we don't short shrift. Super fun exercise where we're going to prioritize measures. So I apologize, but we're just going to keep going. I know this is an interesting and very important topic, but Jessica, please.
Awesome. So really, it's kind of a shame that we're ending with this because, in reality, we probably should have started the meeting with... Oops, let me... Before I get too deep in here. Get up there. Get our presentation up shortly. All right. So, as I was saying, we probably should have started with this. But in reality, this is sort of a congratulations. We took the SERP, which is really the thing that we've been working on really all year for, to our governing board. And that was the first step in sort of the approval process of getting the Community Emissions Reduction Program approved and implemented here in Shafter. So we took that to our board in September. We actually heard from a lot of you, so thank you for those who attended. We really appreciated the support and the feedback, and we really appreciated a lot of what you had to say about moving forward, kind of getting started on all that hard work and starting to really implement and start a lot of this, the development and getting those emissions reductions that we worked so hard to put together. As you all know, for those of you who are super involved, which is a lot of you, in this, which is on every table and it's posted on our website, is really that list of the comprehensive number of measures. It's wide-ranging. We have incentives measures. We have outreach measures. We have regulatory measures. We have measures that are for mobile sources, for industrial sources, for things that will help give money to residents, for things that will help improve roads and sidewalks. There's so much that goes into this. And it really, in reality, it hits at what we're trying to do, which is reduce emissions. So our target in that huge document is to reduce over 265 tons of PM2.5, 1,700 tons of NOx, which is a precursor or a piece of chemical that can react to create more PM2.5 and ozone, and then a variety of air toxics over the project lifetimes of all the things that we're trying to implement. So there's a lot going on, and there are a couple of steps before we can implement, and that's really what we're here today to talk about. The first thing I want you to know is that this is going to the CARB, or the California Air Resources Board. They have to get it approved by their board, and that process will happen here in this room in February. So that's kind of a long ways away. There are a couple of things that are happening in between now and then that we'll talk about here in a minute to kind of solicit your feedback before we officially get that approved by CARB. But there are a couple of things, or actually a variety of things, we can kind of do ahead of that, and that's what we're here today to talk about. So in reality, and we talked about this kind of the last few meetings, the SERP that we developed is really a roadmap. And so there are a couple of things in there that are very, very specific. And there's some things in there that we kind of left a little bit open and we're still soliciting feedback from you. And that's kind of what is going to happen a little bit today. So we really need your input on sort of guiding that implementation. And what I mean by that is, like I said, there are definitely some things that we can start now. There are some things we're already starting to do kind of the moment we adopted that SERP. And so what we're going to do today is go through an exercise to talk about the things that we can start doing that we haven't already started doing that don't require us to wait until CARB approves the SERP. And so I'll tell you what I mean a little bit by that, and I'm going to deviate really quickly. We have a few things here, and Crystal's going to go over the exact details. But we have sort of divided our measures that we went over. Oops, I guess I'll go back to this.
In your packets, you have this sheet right here with the colors. Pull this out. And if you don't have one, there's some in the back.
Yes.
It's the multiple with all the reduction measures.
So those are all those measures that we went over, that we developed together. It's everything. So everything that's in that huge packet, we kind of whittled it down to just a few short words about exactly what it is, and kind of the measure number that's kind of references in the packet. And what we did is we divided that entire list into sort of three stages of implementation. And so we need your feedback on things that are in stage two. So stage one is things are already happening. Things are already getting going. Things are easy to implement. Maybe they don't require funding, or at least not the implementation type of funding like incentives funding. And that's going to be here in green, and that's stage one. So that's things like outreach. That's things like enforcement strategies. These are things that we told you in that SERP that we were going to start immediately, and we are doing it. And we're going to start doing it, and we're ready to go. We also have things that are in stage three that certainly need a lot of feedback from CARB, from their board, and might even need further feedback from our board. These are the things that are those really cool, unique measures that you guys came up with that are things that the district hasn't really ever done before or that require a lot of match funding. So those are in the need to wait on it stage three section. So you'll notice and you can see on there what those require. So those are things like the urban greening measure, which is something we fully have in the SERP. It's definitely going to happen. We probably can't start that tomorrow because there's a lot that needs to be figured out with funding guidelines. So we're going to wait until that CARB hearing in a couple of months, and then we'll start to prioritize those things. But there's a ton of stuff in between. And so today, we're going to go through these stage two items, which are all the items in black on that list. And we have a little packet of them. And these are items where we, as an AIR district, have funding guidelines for them. We know that CARB, it might be something similar to something we've already received funding for. Maybe it's an expansion of a grant program that we already have. Maybe it's targeted outreach or maybe some workshops we want to hold or some partnerships we want to implement that we know we can do right now. But we want to hear from you sort of, there's a lot on there and we can't do it all tomorrow. We can't, not everything can be the number one priority. So we want to sort of hear from you what your number one priority within this stage two group is. So what are the things that you love that you were like, we need to do this as soon as possible? And then what are the things that you're like, you know what, we support these, they're in the SERP, or we understand these need to happen to get reductions, but we don't think they're our number one or number two or even number four priority. We're going to categorize them as, yeah, we like it, it's okay. And then maybe there are some things that aren't love it or like it. We'll just kind of take that if you don't want to categorize them as such, as things that you personally or you as a committee can hold off on for now. That doesn't mean that the district isn't going to do it. It's in the SERP. We're committed. But that might mean when it comes to funding or holding outreach activities or implementing in some other way, we'll do the other things maybe at a higher priority. Maybe they'll get the first round of funding. Does that sort of, I'm going to have Crystal kind of go over the details, but am I making sense that we have sort of three buckets of things and we want your feedback on bucket number two of sort of what you want, what you love, what's your sort of number one through however many priority, and then things that you can kind of wait for.
Great. That was an actually pretty excellent explanation, but I just want to touch on a few things. So all the steering committee members should have a packet. The packet is in order along this sheet, front and back. So if you can't find something, it should just follow this sequence. If you are a member of the public and you want to participate in this exercise, you are welcome to. Come grab a packet over here. We just ask that you write a P in the top corner so we know how to differentiate what the steering committee said versus members of the public. Okay, so this is an individual exercise. You can do this as quickly or as slowly as you'd like, although we will eventually close the meeting down. Like Jessica indicated, you can put up with a little piece of tape the things that you love, the things that you like. You don't have to put everything up, but you're welcome to put everything up. Whatever you'd like to do. I see questions, and then we'll get going.
Quick question. So like right now, alternatives for ag burning. How long, I know this is stage two, but harvest is done, so I'm seeing trees ripped out. How quickly could this get implemented? And then, you know, we've got low dust nut harvesters, but that won't come around till next season. So I'm just curious how soon this will come.
Certainly. So those are both in the stage two. That's just asking what you think is a priority to sort of kick that off here on the Shafter level. But those also happen to be programs that are valley-wide that are happening right now. So this isn't going to mean, you know, even if you put it in Lovett, that doesn't mean we wait until the next round to get these things going. They can still happen immediately. Those alternatives to ag burning, or even especially the low dust harvesters, that takes a long time even to order and get one built and get it created and get it implemented. I don't have, Brian might have a little bit more. How long does it take to get like a low dust?
Right, but that raises an excellent point that this is setting the priorities that you feel are things that you love and things that you like, and then they will be implemented as it's feasible and practical moving forward. It's not black and white. And again, thank you so much for illustrating what this looks like. So at any point in time, you're welcome to stop and order them all you want or start getting up and putting them up. We're a little behind, but let's give everybody a good 5-10 minutes at least, and then we'll kind of look and see where we are. And feel free to ask questions or get help if you have any concerns. Okay. We are coming to the end of our time tonight. But after we do some quick wrap-up, if you want to still put your cards up, you're welcome to. We're just going to do a really quick wrap-up or our next dates, and then Jonathan London is going to say something. So if you can hear me, clap once. If you can hear me, clap twice. If you can hear me, clap three times. Thank you. Okay, real quick. There are two things on the back table. This wasn't effective clapping. If you can hear me, clap four times. Thank you. Okay, this large flyer in the back is a good summary. The next meeting on November 4th, is a joint meeting with both the Air District and CARB. So there's some information on the back table. Additionally, there will be no meeting in December, and then these dates with the January 13th for our January meeting, and then the CARB Governing Board hearing on February 13th. So these are the other really important dates coming up. And there's another thing in the back. We're going to give Jonathan London a few minutes to do a real quick announcement, and then again, if you have more things to hang up, you're welcome to, but I do want to honor the fact that this is the end of the meeting technically, so I don't want to keep you guys here later than you need to be.
Hi, good evening, everybody. As Crystal mentioned, I'm Jonathan London. I'm a professor at UC Davis, and I'm working under contract with CARB, California Resources Board, to conduct an evaluation of community participation in the AB 617 process here in Shafter, but also in the other 9 communities throughout the state that have these initial pilot grants. So we're doing a survey, and I'm going to pass out now. I have some of these in Spanish, and then I have some others in English. Thanks, Crystal. So that describes the study. But basically, we're trying to help steering committees, help CARB, help the regional air districts all reflect on the work, the amazing work that you're doing over these last, you know, year and a half, to be able to see, you know, what's working really well, what have been more challenging areas, what are some ways that the process could be improved so that ARB and the air districts and others can figure out what are some ways forward that can make you meet your goals in even more powerful, effective ways. So we have a survey, and there's a link at the bottom of the sheet that went around it, and the survey is both in Spanish and in English. So please fill that out. It should take just no more than 10 minutes, and it's really useful for us to gather as wide perspective of people's experiences with AB617. And then we're doing a series of interviews, and I've been doing that today with people here that have been terrific. And then we're participating at these meetings. So we'll have the draft of our evaluation report will be out to this group and the rest committees in March. So please be on the lookout for that, and there'll be a way for you to give us feedback to make sure that, you know, we're really capturing things accurately. There's nothing that we missed, or maybe we mischaracterized something. And then to get your other ideas of things that also should be in that report. And then we'll have the final report out in June. And hopefully, again, that will be a resource for you. So we're hopeful that this will be a helpful resource for people. And I really welcome your feedback on the survey. And I'll be here after the meeting, too, if anyone wants to talk with me. So thanks so much for the opportunity to speak with you. This was a really impressive meeting. It looks like there's a ton of things on love and fewer things on like. So it's a very enthusiastic group, clearly. There's a lot of things this group loves. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Jonathan. Okay. Thank you so much. Again, stick around if you want to keep adding things to our big posters over here. And if not, we will see you next time on November 4th, same time. Thank you so much. And again, there's food if you want to take the food home. Thank you.